Hello and welcome to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths podcast. My name is Umair. I am the Knowledge to Action Lead with Gen Squeeze. I am joined today by my colleague Paul Kershaw, Gen Squeeze's founder and a policy professor at UBC's School of Population and Public Health. And this is, I think, the first time I've emphasized the specific department.
I was going to say, because we're going to talk about healthcare today, aren't we? And I'm a prof at the School of Population and Health. Yes. Giving me street cred.
And this is actually a really special episode of the podcast because this is the first time we're doing it in person.
And not only that, it's my first time being in the same physical space with you after a year of collaborating together. So that is exciting too.
Yeah. So Paul, he's here in Ottawa. He's usually out in BC. Your visit happens to coincide with the First Minister's meeting that took place yesterday.
It absolutely is useful to be here at the moment the First Ministers are meeting. Because while we're here, we're talking about a range of issues that Gen Squeeze focuses on. Whether that's housing affordability or budgeting fairly for young and old alike, and I've been focusing a lot on the growth in old age security or trying to fix how we measure housing inflation or childcare. We also do a lot on healthcare. And so yesterday there was this very interesting set of meetings amongst our first ministers where the federal government put on offer $198 billion of new money over the next decade to go directly to medical care. And our premiers relatively uniformly said they didn't think it was that much money.
Oh, it's 196 over the next 10 years, and 46 billion is.
So it's $198 billion in total new money that the feds put in. Two of that, though, will go directly to Indigenous communities, so it will not be filtered through provinces. So that's why the provinces only spoke about the 196. We've already lost everyone now, sorry, Mayor. And some would claim that only about 45 or 46 of that is new money. What it means is actually coming into the meetings yesterday, the provinces already knew that they could count on the federal government for kicking in an extra about $150 billion in new money. And then on top of that, they received an announcement from the prime minister and the finance minister that they would accelerate that still further. And so in the media commentary that we've had in the not even 24 hours since this happened, there has been some discussion, is it $198 billion that's new, or is it only 46? The answer is it's all new. It's all on top of what is actually currently being spent right now. And so that makes it new money. Some of it was already planned. Some of it is now a new injection.
Right. Okay. That makes sense, actually. And I didn't get that from the media reports on this.
The media is actually quite confused about that point and actually relates about another conversation. I was at the finance ministry today pleading with both political officials in Chrystia Freeland's office and also assistant deputy minister staff who actually are responsible for putting the budget together. And they're there regardless of which party is in play. And was drawing attention, like, you never feature the biggest thing in the federal budget, which is, you know, for instance, 5 years from now, they project that old age security spending will grow by $28 billion in a single year. And that growth in a single year will be bigger than the entire budget for employment insurance, almost as big as the entire budget for the Canada Child Benefit, which has been enormously important for reducing the financial squeeze on families with kids and reducing child poverty. It's four times more than the entire $10 a day child care budget will be at that time. In one single year, old age security is dwarfing all of that, just the growth of it. And I was like, why do you not report that to Canadians so that we can talk about this and know are we investing fairly in young and old alike? And the finance minister or the ADM said to me, well, you know, we tend to only talk about funding that results from new decisions. And as she and I both observed yesterday, though, the prime minister stood up and said they're injecting $198 billion of new money into medical care. Some of that is results of decisions made in the last few days. Some of that reflects decisions that were made in the past. But if that's appropriate for characterizing what the feds are doing on medical care, it should also be appropriate for describing what the feds are doing with regards to spending on retirement income for the seniors we love. And I really hope that we can use that angle to help improve some of the budgeting for all generations work that we do at Gen Squeeze, while also pivoting and saying, we got to put in context this new money for medical care. We have to resist the idea from premiers that it's not a lot of new money. And, well, we should talk about that more now.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's the other angle that you hear on in the media is the premiers are saying this is just a down payment.
Yeah, that's Premier Ford, a down payment. Premier Ford, I thought, was very good at the politicking yesterday compared to some of the premiers. He was clearly trying to say it's not a, you know, it's not as much as premiers want, but he's not trying to run too afoul with his federal colleagues and then the kind of nice bromance that's unfolded between the federal Liberals and the Ontario Conservatives. So here's what we would say at Generation Squeeze, and in combination with colleagues at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives and their Think Upstream work, at the National Collaborating Center for Determinants of Health, other research experts at UBC, at the University of Calgary and Dalhousie University. We would say to premiers, never forget that the science tells us that we can't achieve the transformation, innovation, the big fix for our medical care system that everyone's been talking about around the First Minister's meeting by only focusing on medicine. Because the medical care system accounts for just not even a quarter of what makes us healthy and well. The science is clear on that. Health doesn't begin at a hospital or a doctor's office. Health begins where we're born, grow, live, work, and age. And that means so long as Canadians can't access, you know, decent incomes, quality childcare, good homes, a healthy environment, the medical care system will never be enough to prevent people from dying early. So to premiers, if you really want to slow the flow of sickness into your doctor's offices and hospitals, a flow that is too high right now, which creates long wait lists and Canadians from coast to coast to coast fearful about the time they're waiting in long lines to get care when they've fallen sick. And simultaneously, we are burning out doctors and nurses who are increasingly feeling demoralized that they can't keep up with the long line of people needing their care. You can't fix that by only putting more money to treat illness when people fall sick. The transformation comes from, let's prevent people from falling sick when they don't need to. Let's invest in our neighborhoods, our childcares, our schools, in our environment so that people will have the conditions they need to be healthy and thrive, not just some good care after we failed them at that and they fall sick.
Okay, so you just went over a lot and we're going to have to go back over some of it, I think, in a bit more detail, because I think a lot of what you're saying is counterintuitive.
So you think most Canadians, oh my God, so rude, so rude. That's another team member calling us, but I'm sorry, Andrea, I'm putting you on mute. So rude. I'm so sorry.
It's okay, don't worry.
So no, you were just saying it's counterintuitive. So you think most of our listeners will think that actually what makes us healthy and well is if we can get access to a doctor.
Well, I think what most of our listeners are probably thinking about when they're thinking about the crisis in our healthcare system is about how much more money is needed, how it needs to be tracked, how it needs to be spent. That's where the conversation is. And what you're talking about is seems like a completely different conversation.
I know, but look, so you're right. The dominant conversation coming in around this meeting was how much more do we need to spend in order to treat people when they're sick? How much of that will flow to private clinics versus staying in the public system? And how much more of it will we use to pay in particular doctors? Family doctors specifically, because we're worried that so many of them train. We have more family doctors per capita than we have had in the past. The problem seems to be they don't seem to want to be in family practice, in part because they can make more money in other specializations. We're like, well, how do we increase their salaries, their earnings? These are all important questions, but their answers are not sufficient to actually solve the problems in the healthcare system. They're not the answers about what makes people well, and they sure as heck aren't going to reduce the wait lists necessarily for care because we haven't actually stopped the flow of sickness into our system. There's just more sickness flowing in there. Partly we have an older population, so there's more frailty there. And we've been retreating from investing in the social determinants of health. That's a phrase we use a lot at the School of Population Health and at UBC and in faculties of medicine across the country. And so we need to wrestle. Like the science on health is clear. You're more likely to improve life expectancy, reduce avoidable deaths, reduce avoidable sickness, if you grow spending on social things like childcare, housing, poverty reduction, by comparison with medical care. The science is emphatic about that.
Okay, so then what we're really trying to do is reframe the discussion, right? So let's go back over another point you made. You said that only a quarter of health outcomes are determined by the spending that goes into medical care.
Yeah, probably less than that, but about a quarter, a little less.
Yeah, so I was looking at a Senate report from 2009.
Yeah, that's one place where you'll find that stat. That's good. Yeah, it was a nice synthesis from back in the day.
It says that medical care, quote, only accounts for 25% of health outcomes regardless of the level of funding it receives. The socioeconomic environment is the most powerful of the determinants of health.
Yeah, and so then people don't often recognize that Generation Squeeze has been this social determinants of health organization. We haven't used that phrase because it's not really meaningful to people, but why we focus on younger demographic earns less, thousands of dollars left after adjusting for inflation compared to, say, when baby boomers came of age, even though they're more than twice as likely to have post-secondary, paid more for that privilege and start with more student debt as a result, only to face home prices that are so much higher, eat up so much more of their income, makes homeownership out of reach for longer periods of time. People then have to pay more for rent. So this is a huge deterioration in young people's socioeconomic circumstances. It happens at the moment that they are also in their prime childbearing and rearing years. Young people have been delaying. You know, when baby boomers came of age, the average age of birthing was in the low 20s. Now it's around 30. It's especially high in BC, where the cost of living pressures would be the greatest. We have the highest age of birthing and the most cesarean section procedures as a result. And so we have been deteriorating the socioeconomic contributors to young people from the economy. And then Jen Squeeze points out we're really slow to compensate for that by investing with tax dollars, whether that was childcare or, you know, reducing student tuition or, you know, trying to tackle housing prices. We don't do that with the same urgency that we invest, say, in medical care for the aging population or those who are requiring retirement income support.
Right. And by the time this podcast is published, Jen Squeeze will have launched an initiative that we're calling Get Well Canada. We'll be doing this along with a number of other organizations and people. And you've already sort of described some of what that initiative is meant to do. It's going to be called Get Well Canada. I do want to return, though, because again, Paul, I think to you, this is very, you know, it's not counterintuitive to you. You're a professor in this field. You understand what the scientific literature says on it. But I think the public discourse, the political discourse is very far behind. We were even chatting about this. You weren't there at the meeting yesterday. But, you know, we were talking about even the use of the word science in regards to this. And I was making the point that I think if we say that, you know, the science shows this, I don't know that that will come across as believable to people. In the same way as something like, you know, the science on climate change. I think when we say that the science on climate change is clear, you know, climate is changing, this is how it's happening, and that these will be the repercussions. In this case, the public sort of attention is just not on the social determinants of health.
It wasn't always that way, though. So in 1976, a decade after we kind of launched into building our public medical care system, provinces consistently spent more on social and education issues than they did on medical care. Often a quarter to a third more.
Yeah, so I have the data here in front of me.
Oh, okay.
Let's look at BC. So in the mid-70s, BC spent 22% more on social and education spending than it did on medical spending. In 2019, it spent 28% less. So, and BC is sort of the middle of the pack. But if you look at somewhere like Newfoundland, social and education spending was 55% higher than medical spending in the mid-1970s. Now it's about 50% less.
Yeah. So that does reflect a range of factors, more than we're going to be able to talk about today. But one of them is just a deprioritization of the importance of investing not just in treating illness, but actually investing in health and health promotion and caring about people well, being well, and saying, we know that what makes people well is these conditions into which we're born, grow, live, work, and age. And if it seems counterintuitive, people, let's think back to the pandemic, the beginning of the pandemic. Your likelihood of falling sick with COVID-19 was everything related to like where you were working, your housing, your income. And these, you know, we came to be quite clear on the way in which the social determinants were exposing us to the risk of COVID in different ways. I should have said like racial, you know, our racial membership and our ethnocultural membership, because that's also filtering us into different parts of the economy. And so I think we came to realize during COVID that the last stop in our healthcare is actually the doctor's office or the emergency room. The first stops are the childcare center, the school, the community center, the economy more generally. And indeed, during the pandemic, this is one moment where actually, especially at the federal level, our emergency response absolutely aligned with the science about health promotion. Disproportionately, the federal government invested in income supports, wage supplements, keeping businesses alive, even more than what they were pouring into the medical care system, which was needing to adapt to the pressures of, wow, COVID's bringing a lot more sick people into our offices, and there are too many nurses and doctors and medical professionals who are falling sick, and so we're getting shortages. At Jen Squeeze and at Get Well Canada, with our colleagues, as I mentioned, at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, National Collaborating Center for Determinants of Health, Universities of Calgary, Dalhousie University, UBC, we had hoped that the wisdom that came from like, during an emergency, we saw that we needed to invest where health begins and protect people there to try and avoid the risks of their catching the contagion, that would persist into the future. But now that we are, you know, at a different point in the pandemic, you can see that yesterday, in particular, the premiers were framing the dialogue as if what we need first and foremost is more for medicine. And they didn't give to the federal government credit that actually, as provinces have been treating from leading on social spending and education spending, the federal government has had to step in more. They have a national housing strategy. It could be better, yes, but they're doing that. They have now the $10 a day childcare strategy. I want them to do it faster, but they're doing it. They have a poverty reduction strategy. And whereas in 1976, the provinces were consistently spending more on social issues than were the federal government, if you flash forward to today, now the federal government is more often having to lead on the social issue, and they're spending more on that issue than the provinces. And amazingly, that means, indeed, the federal government, contrary to what the premiers have been saying, they've been leading on investing where health begins. They're not getting credit for that from provinces and their political leaders, or Canadians, I think, more generally. But that's why Get Well Canada has to help broaden how Canadians understand what makes us healthy and well.
Yes, but see, I don't think that even from the standpoint of the federal government, and certainly from the standpoint of how the public saw it and how the media reported on it, the spending that took place during the pandemic on, you know, income supports and supporting businesses and whatnot, it didn't take place from the standpoint of a health measure. It was meant to counteract the effect that COVID had on the economy.
Oh, well, fair enough, but I'll push back a little on that front. So why did we have to have these emergency income supports? Well, because we said you can't go out of your house as much, you can't go to work as much, you can't send your kids to school as much, they're not going to be able to have access to childcare, because like those conditions where, you know, in this case it's a contagious disease, like they're riskier now. Then though, I think so much of the conversation is like, what harm has that caused to children? What harm has that caused to the mental health of Canadians from coast to coast to coast? All that isolation. We didn't let people go and visit their loved ones in seniors care facilities out of fear that that would augment their risk of catching COVID. And then we allowed them to spend months and months in isolation, which clearly was compromising their well-being and thereby then leading to different kinds of physical ailments that flow from stress and anxiety. I'm going to push back. I think Canadians have a clearer sense of there's a relationship between our socioeconomic circumstances and our health, more so than in the past. True, that's not how these discussions were framed when the first ministers came together in Ottawa, but so much of Jen Squeeze's work, and now with our Get Well Canada colleagues more generally, we're in the business of trying to reframe the dialogue so that people actually see the connections between evidence and reality and when there's a mismatch.
Yeah, well, I would just say, I mean, we all at that point, you know, it was probably the first time in Canadian history when everyone was watching the briefings, you know, whether it was the prime minister talking or the federal and provincial health ministers. I mean, and the messaging was not about the social determinants of health, right? So I'm just saying, I think when we come to this discussion, we really have to be cognizant that the conversation is not where we want it to be.
Okay, so then I'm going to like set aside science. Let me try and make meaning of the science. So at Get Well Canada, we're trying to make meaning of the science. You know, we often ask people, if you were presented with the choice of having to jump out of the window of your burning home or do what was involved in preventing the home from starting on fire in the first place, which would you do? And, you know, the answer to that is a really straightforward one. People clearly would prioritize the prevention side of the equation. So now think about that fire metaphor in the context of the healthcare system. Our doctors and nurses and other medical care professionals, they're firefighters. Things have gone wrong. People have fallen sick. And so we need to go to the heroes, the firefighters, to help, you know, deal with that illness. But doctors want to often say they want to be able to prescribe poverty reduction, childcare, housing, and can't. Doctors and nurses say, sure, you can pay me more, but I'm still going to be up till 3 a.m. managing my client load, my patient load. And what I ultimately need is to not burn out. And so I think that what we need to remember is that we need to find a better balance between fire prevention in the medical care system and doing the work, firefighting in the medical care system and doing the work of fire prevention. And the work of fire prevention is investing where we're born, grow, live, and grown age. It's improving childcare. It's improving housing. It's improving poverty reduction and a range of other things, actually. But we don't do that. When the premiers tell us we need more money for medical care and that's our top priority, then our budgeting increasingly uses more and more of the returns from economic growth in society and allocates it to medical care, the illness treatment side of the equation. And then it leaves little left over for the ministers responsible for housing and childcare and poverty reduction and education and fighting climate change. And that then means we're not budgeting for well-being, we're budgeting for illness treatment. And at Get Well Canada, our colleagues are saying, now is the time to remember the wisdom from Tommy Douglas. Maybe some of your listeners will know Tommy Douglas. He's often credited as being the father of Canadian medical care. Tommy Douglas, in many of his speeches, including one of his last speeches in the legislature, said, remember, the purpose of medical care is to keep people well, not to patch them up when they fall sick. That's what Get Well Canada is about. That's what Gen Squeeze is all about. And so we are one of the louder voices critiquing when medical care routinely wins at the budget table and leaves too little left over to invest in the things that make us well.
And so the reframing that we're offering is that when we talk about health, we usually, what we're talking about is medical care, medical treatment. And what we need to actually be doing is talking about a health care system more broadly.
Yeah, let's really focus on health and not just medicine. And so there's this opportunity right now where, in addition to talking a lot about medical care in our world of politics these days, people are concerned about inflation and cost of living. That is probably actually more generally the dominant conversation these days in the world of politics. And this is an opportunity for us because when our governments fight cost of living pressures through making childcare less expensive, through doing things to relieve the pressures of housing unaffordability by focusing on those who have the least income and wealth with poverty reduction measures, not only do those things address the cost of living pressures, it turns out that's good for the healthcare system because it slows the flow of sickness into our medical centers. It's a winning on two crises with a single investment. Now, that's the kind of wise, efficient budgeting that we all want from our political leaders, regardless of what party affiliation we have.
Right. And so I think that's a really important point to underscore.
The social side of health. Health, medical care, and social investments are flip side of the same healthcare coin.
Yeah, so I think that's important. But I actually want to go back and talk a little bit about how we got here.
Yeah.
So we highlighted the fact that in the 70s, we had more social and education spending, you know, compared with healthcare. Now it's the other way around. You know, and healthcare is a big deal. It's a major part of our GDP. I think it accounts for something like 13% of all jobs in Canada.
Smaller share of GDP, bigger share of employment.
I think it's about 7% GDP.
Yeah. Way less than housing, by the way. Way less than lots of, but no, you're right. It does a decent amount of employment because other than doctors and nurses who definitely are amongst the top 1-2% of our earners in our country. You know, the nurses and care aides and whatnot often are, you know, not getting pay equity level wages.
But it also occupies a very important place in our national sort of mythos. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, in the last episode, we were talking about American nationalism a little bit with Megan and Kareem. And Canadian nationalism, you know, it does, its foundational myth isn't about sort of overthrowing tyranny. We didn't overthrow the British, but we put in place a healthcare system, a publicly funded healthcare system, or I guess to be precise, medical care system.
Yeah.
And so that actually is a foundational part of Canadian nationalism.
So you asked, like, how did we get here? I think there are three quick answers. We've been talking about one. The Get Well Canada part of the story is that we've failed to prioritize the fire prevention over the firefighting when thinking about promoting health. You're picking up on a second piece, which is when it comes to promoting health, Canadians have this thorny problem where we distinguish ourselves from our neighbors to the south in no small part by saying we're not them because we have publicly funded medical care. And as a result, we have a cultural reaction to, like, when should we do, you know, when we're being the best versions of ourselves, the most just versions of ourselves, and we get called by a pollster, what should politicians do more of? Our cultural reaction is, put more into medical care. We'll call it healthcare. Put more into healthcare. Even though the science actually would say, don't, that's not the first place to next invest our dollars if we really want to promote health and well-being and slow the flow of sickness. But the cultural reaction is that, so that then moves the political dials so that there isn't a single political party that does not campaign federally or provincially to win our votes by offering more money, and often more money for medical care than anything else. So that's a cultural problem. And then the third problem, and this is more, you know, this comes back more to the bread and butter of Gen Squeeze. But the third problem is the aging family members who we love, who are now at a moment where biologically they need to count more on medicine and retirement income for that matter. While they were working, they weren't asked by the system of the day, or they didn't recognize that they needed to tell the system of the day that they weren't paying enough in taxes to cover what they would want to use for medical care and retirement when they got older. What they were doing is they were paying enough taxes at the time to cover the retirement income and the medical care of the seniors that were around then. But when baby boomers started out in the labor market, there were 7 workers for every retiree. As baby boomers retire, there are fewer than 4 workers for every retiree, and soon there will be fewer than 3. And so one of the reasons why we have more family doctors and more doctors more generally per capita than we used to, and yet there's this long wait list, is that we haven't slowed the flow of sickness into our medical care system, and we haven't had a conversation with our aging loved ones which said, I hate to tell you this, while you paid taxes your entire life, you didn't pay at a level that's going to cover how you want to draw on the healthcare system now. And so there's a kind of there's a cash constraint there in terms of the wants for the medical care system. We're compensating by using all this economic growth to filter it over there, but then that's a bad deal for their kids and grandchildren who then get underinvested in when it comes to post-secondary or childcare or housing and so on.
Yeah, so some of this is really just the outcome of the demographic changes that have been taking place.
No, I'm not willing to concede that point. That is too easy. I just had that conversation earlier today in finance. No, here are some facts. There are around 4 million more retirees today by comparison with 1976. And that has driven more than $30 billion in additional annual spending on medical care for those over 65. By contrast, there are 4.6 million more people under 45 with post-secondary certificates today by comparison with 1976. That additional 4.6 million person demographic change resulted in less than $3 billion in new money for post-secondary, one-tenth. So 4.6 million young people needing more post-secondary, they get one-tenth of what 4 million seniors needing more medical care is resulting in medical care. That's a choice, not just demographics. And let me give you another example. There's 2.5 million more young women in their prime childbearing and rearing years in the labor market today by comparison with 1976. And we've increased spending on parental leave and childcare prior to the $10 a day investment by only about $6 billion. So there are demographic shifts, and then there are political decisions to address those demographic shifts. Both contribute to the spending outcomes, but do not let anyone tell you it is just demographics driving the change. It is political priorities, and that's part of the broken generational system because we're not prioritizing younger Canadians and future generations.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. There's nothing that is outside of politics. So, you know, demographic changes happen, cultural changes, social changes happen, but they interact with our political sphere, and the decisions we make obviously are our own. We have agency.
We have agency as a society. It will affect, you know, parties differently, but this is one of the kind of the hard truths of Gen Squeeze. You know, I think we've said before, I might not be nailing it when I say it this way, but like, I think we get the politics we deserve. We create the political cover for politicians to take action on what we care about. Politicians rarely say, citizenry, right now we're going over to point A over there, when where we really need to go is to point B. Let me lead you to point B. Most elected officials will say, my citizenry is going to point A. Let me lead them there. So we signal where politics often takes us, and it becomes this kind of reinforcing cycle. And so I guess earlier in this conversation, Umair, you told me, Paul, it's counterintuitive what you're saying about what promotes health. And because it is still counterintuitive for too many Canadians, because I guess that means I'm failing at my job as a professor and mobilizing that knowledge into the world of Canadian culture and society and public discussion, then we're not creating the political cover for the politicians to lead where we need them to go. They're just responding to the polling, and the polling suggests if you put more money in medical care, I suspect that's going to make it better, even though even the premiers weren't buying that yesterday in their press conference. They know there's more than just money that's required.
Yeah, but I mean, our politics isn't necessarily driven by polling. I think there's other things going on here. I mean, like, you know, most Canadians want, for instance, action on climate change. You know, they've wanted that for a long time. And so I don't know. This is maybe a different conversation.
You know, that's. I think this is an interesting part of our dialogue over time. And for, yes, you know, listeners who follow more than one episode in the Hard Truths podcast, I think one thing I keep learning from Umair is his observing, Paul, I think you don't recognize the cynicism that many Canadians now have in politics, because politics isn't always responding to the signals that we're giving, that there are other forces, other power dynamics, other lobbying, other constituencies, you know, with wealth and affluence and often, you know, companies. I guess right now many are angry about like food inflation and big food companies. And so I guess our narrative often doesn't go to those kinds of contributors to the problem. And I wonder...
Well, I'm not even sure if that's what I'm saying.
Okay, come back to me.
I mean, I think even if you look at our political discourse on climate change, you know, it's not as if, you know, people in government don't believe in climate change. They certainly do. I mean, I'm sure they're quite sincere. But, you know, I think our institutions, for whatever reason, they seem to be unable to actually deliver. And it's the same in the business world. Like, they talk about climate change and the impacts that it'll have on them and their ability to function, make money. They're quite sincere, but there's something that doesn't allow us to actually take action.
Well, I think there's a kind of short-termism, you know, that often grabs our attention. So, you know, why do people think that healthcare is so much about medicine? Because you can see the heroism of the doctors, you know, addressing the needs of someone with cancer. Right. You can see that person getting the treatment. You can see them go through the hell of chemo and losing hair and whatnot. But within some months, more often than not these days, they're healthier again. The illness has gone away. It's so much harder to see the years before it, the ways in which, you know, social conditions might be shaping why someone fell sick with any of a range of ailments. So it's so much harder to see prevention than to see treating a crisis in the moment. And this matters for fighting, you know, promoting well-being rather than treating illness. This matters for climate change. I was reading recently that if you were an alien who wanted to come on, you know, sort of, you know, take up, you know, conquer the human species, you wouldn't come down with guns blazing from your spaceships, because that would rally human beings like, we need to resist and respond. We can see that problem. You would have a slow, slow burn over years that people just didn't see as an immediate threat, and we would ignore it. And so I think many people now know that, you know, we need to resist climate change. We need to do our adaptations. But, you know, do people actually see changing the amount of gasoline they use, you know, paying for pollution, you know, thinking about how you might, you know, get on airplanes less, like those kinds of adaptations? are people ready for that? I'm less convinced by that. And so I think that we have a hard time having a longer term vision and seeing problems unfold in a slow way, but they're ultimately disastrous. And I think Jen squeezes like, people, we are on a slow drive to crisis in government budgeting because we're absorbing all the good stuff for an aging population and leaving a lousy legacy for their kids and grandchildren. It's the same for climate change. And we have been extracting so much of the good stuff from our housing system and giving wealth to homeowners, myself included, and especially those who are older, and leaving unaffordability as the legacy. It's the same. In this case, it's the same pattern of a broken generational system. And that's hard for, I think it's hard for individuals to see the pattern of the system in a as it moves more slowly, but has such harmful consequences.
Yeah, so to tie it back to where, to health and to where I think the prevention of illness, I think that that's seen in our society as a kind of individual responsibility.
Eat better, do more exercise.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Unfortunately, again, the science is clear, you know, that those eating patterns and exercise patterns and what have you, and floss and patterns and whatever, I was just hearing about dental stuff today on the radio, they're all shaped by our social conditions. They're shaped by the opportunities we can or cannot access because of the distribution of power related to race and class and sex and sexuality and newcomer status and colonization. And then that filters out into the homes and jobs that we're able to access or not, the education we're able to access or not. And that then shapes the communities with whom we're spending and the patterns that we see. And that then gives rise to our eating habits and our exercise habits and what have you. And of course, any individual in a social group can take personal responsibility and sort of buck the trends of what they're seeing in their social networks. And that is something we can expect of one another. We can expect personal responsibility. That's why Jen Squeeze so often says, problem is when people take personal responsibility and they work hard, when young people do that these days, hard work doesn't pay off like it used to. Why? Because the system around us is breaking down. You can't go, you know, you used to have to work 5 years to save enough money to cover 20% for a down payment on an average priced home. That's what it was like when baby boomers came in. Now you'd have to work 18 years. Is it, you know, the individual decision to do that? No, it's the system decision. Then the individual struggles with that. And so they have to scrimp on what they're eating. They're going to be spending more time going to work. They're going to have more parental time in the labor market. They'll have less time for that exercise and doing these other things that might make us well. And worse still, they'll be stressed. And stress is literally the biological mechanism by which our environment gets under the skin and under our scalp and influences our biological responses. And if that environment is good and whatnot, then we don't experience a lot of stress. But if we're experiencing stress, that chronic stress can slowly but surely influence our organs and our biological systems and give rise to sickness and mental ill health and well-being for that matter.
Yeah, and then that overburdens our medical care system.
Exactly.
Just to bring the point home. Yeah.
Thank you very much for making the conclusion. And then we have a long line at our doctor's offices and our clinics, and we burn out our nurses and our doctors and other medical care professionals. And here's the situation that we're talking about solving right now.
And so that's, I guess, what we're trying to do is we're trying to draw a line from the housing crisis to the crisis in healthcare.
Can I just add, draw a line from the housing crisis to healthcare, draw a line from the childcare crisis to healthcare, draw a line for the unfathomable amounts of poverty we're still tolerating in one of the richest societies in the world to healthcare, the wealth inequality to healthcare. And, you know, but this, I feel for small businesses these days, I feel for employers more generally, like it's so hard for them now to pay a living wage that can cover our basic needs when we've lost control of housing. And so the mismatch between housing and what employers literally can pay then gives rise to this massive stress in society, which gives rise to ill health.
Yeah, and so just to go back to the point about how we see prevention of ill health as personal responsibility, you know, it's interesting. As Canadians, we see treatment of illness as a social responsibility.
Yeah.
And I think we should start seeing prevention of illness as a social responsibility as well.
So let's then bring that back to Get Well Canada and its mission. And so with our colleagues, we're really trying to, you know, to focus on what's necessary to complete our healthcare system. And we have these sort of series of changes that we want to see, and it gets a little bit wonky. The first thing that we want to do is we want to say, there's this Canadian Institute for Health Information. Every year, it gives us tons and tons of data about what's going on in the medical care system. It's where Jen Squeeze goes routinely to tell us by province how much money is being spent on medical care and how does it break down by age, for instance. But it doesn't simultaneously report what are we spending on the social and educational things that prevent ill health and promote wellness. And so it gives us an incomplete vision, even though its mandate as the Canadian Institute for Health Information is better data, better decisions, healthier Canadians. Well, they're not giving us enough data, so it's giving us short-sighted decisions or imbalanced decisions that without enough information, and then we're not getting healthier Canadians. So Get Well Canada says, we're right now monitoring how much we spend on medicine versus social and education issues. We'll do that, but we ultimately need it picked up by CIHI, the Canadian Institute for Health Information. Then we need our governments to be monitoring provincially and federally. What are they doing to grow spending on social issues? What are they doing for medical care issues? And are they growing the social side more urgently? Because that's what the science tells us is necessary, not only to promote life expectancy and reduce avoidable death and sickness, but also to tackle the cost of living crisis, right, that we're facing right now. And the third thing we're doing is culture change, which I guess is what this very podcast dialogue is about. Because we ultimately know that public opinion constrains political action. And if it remains counterintuitive for people that healthcare isn't the primary thing driving our health, then it will be very hard to ever encourage politicians of any political stripe to begin to rebalance their budgets and invest where health begins. So check us out at getwellcanada.ca, a great group of partners, and I hope more and more people do see that all along, Jen Squeeze didn't necessarily use the language of health and well-being in our first years, because what we knew is, I guess to your point, it's counterintuitive, but we said if we work on these social determinants of health, childcare, housing, climate change, and whatnot, we'll get more wellness and a healthier population. That's our goal. But coming out of the pandemic, where we've been so focused on health and what, it really just oriented so many Canadians on health and health care, I think we're just at this critical moment where we have to have this gut check, this heart check, this head check. What makes us healthy and well? And it doesn't start with our medical care system.